All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here in lovely studio Fist in Your Face in Salt Lake City with another live studio audience. Thanks, guys. I brought two of our good friends back for another in our philosophical series. First of all, to my left is the lovely Adam. Hey, Adam.
Hello, John. Hello, everyone.
Welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And also joining us is the effervescent Angie. Hey, Angie.
Good afternoon. Good evening. Hello, everybody.
Hello. All right. Well, let's jump right in. We've got so much to cover and so little time. The episode tonight is on George Orwell. We've done our Verses series where we try to compare Mormonism and Mormon thinking to prominent philosophers of the age. And tonight we're doing George Orwell. And by just pure happy coincidence, the church happened to give me a whole bunch of Orwellian news stories to lead off with. Thanks, guys. First of all, this recording on Tuesday, of course. This last weekend was Women's Conference. A couple of new changes, new speak, as it were, in Women's Conference. First of all, for the first time ever, they introduced this as the opening session of conference. So now the Women's Conference is now officially a part of the church conference. So yay, congratulations to our sisters in the church who have now joined at least into conference. Another one that I have to, in fact, chide the ex-Mormons on, a huge, I hate to point fingers at the Mormon feminists also, a huge landmark. This conference, the first ever, a black woman gave an opening prayer, and the DAMU missed it. They didn't report on it at all until they got called out on it. And then, they said, well, congratulations to the first woman of color. And then somebody pointed out, actually, that was last year. It was the first black woman to ever give a prayer in conference. So yay, the church, nice. way to go. It's only been how long since 1978? The women's conference, still stands it is the LDS women's conference. There's been a lot of press releases and whatnot. Still stands with the, men being the keynote speakers at the women's conference. So we still have a little ways to go. And in another Orwellian twist, of course, the church blacked it out. For the first time ever, the press was not allowed at the women's conference. The LDS spokesman said, that's just so we stay in sync with our others. If you recall, to shut down ordained women, in the spring, the church blacked out conference and banned all press, any recording devices and cameras from the temple grounds during conference. So that was extended to this session also. So yeah, you always know an organization is healthy and vibrant when they do a blackout of the press. That's always a good sign. Other great stories, seminary graduation standards. The church announced this week that they're going up. They couldn't go down. If it was the same as when I was there. I wonder, and we're going to get to this when we talk about Orwell. I don't want to blow our load early, but how they're going to start testing. The church announced they're going to have two cycles of testing in the year. This is going to pose a challenge for the church because the church is always about studying but never learning anything, right? So exactly what they're going to test on will be a real curiosity to see what exactly they test on. I mean, you can only put pray and obey and do your home teaching on so many questions before you run out of stuff.
What are they going to test on?
That's my question. I looked over the press release and I couldn't see anything. So, and our lead story, the church announced that the LDS Church Museum is going to close for a year. It's going to close for a year so that they can fix it. And this is a great example of doublespeak. Again, I don't want to get too far down our Orwellian path, but there's a great quote that came from the Deseret News, actually, from the senior curator Kurt Graham, and he says, "We want members of the church and people outside the church who are looking for information to get a very consistent message. We don't want them to hear one thing in the museum and something else on the church's internet site and something else on a historical site and something else on the Smith papers. It's all one message. We want to coordinate that so that the real latest scholarship we're aware of is available in all these venues, in all these channels for the public. Real historians do not have to coordinate anything. If you just put in the museum historical artifacts, then the term coordination never has to enter in, nor do you have to set up a committee between the different departments. This is Ministry of Truth action. Oh, this is not what historians do. Historians do not coordinate amongst themselves, right? If you find something that is historical, you don't have to confer with the ministry to find out if it's acceptable. Here's where the doublespeak comes in. Ironically, in the so that this was sort of the pro article in the Deseret, well, the Deseret News, that they talked about this coordination. In the Tribune, they were the church officials were quote. So we just read from the Deseret News that the goal here is to coordinate this with church history because we know the Smith paper has been coming out, more transparency, blah 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 blah. So you'd get from that idea that we're going to turn this museum less propaganda and more historical, right? That's kind of what that quote would lead you to believe. Let's see what the Tribune has to say about it. The LDS Church to close, and they said the change is planned to give greater emphasis to Jesus Christ. And these are the words of the Tribune and the so-called first vision of the Lord by Mormon founder Joseph Smith.
Which version?
Well, so on the one hand, we have that the museum is closing down to be more historically accurate. And how are they going to be more historically accurate? The Church History Museum is going to emphasize more about Jesus Christ. And they quoted as saying, it will be much clearer to people that we are a Christian church.
After they bury all of the bad stuff, it will be more clear that we are a Christian church.
Right. Well, it's unfortunate. Now, if you're in Salt Lake City and you're interested in Mormon history, which is a legitimate interest, head on up the hill by the Capitol to the Daughters of Utah Pioneer Museum. It's an old-style museum, and you see lots of weird shit and all sorts of fun things. The Church History Museum has really gutted itself. I don't know what's going to be now. It's going to be like a wax museum to Jesus, I guess, is what it's going to be in the future. I don't know how Jesus has anything to do with church history. I mean, the Mormons believe in Jesus. Okay, we get it. But we don't need a whole church history museum devoted to the fact saying, hey, guys, we're Christians too.
But this, John, really ties into one of the main themes from what we will be discussing tonight, and that's the distinction between fact and truth. And oftentimes, these seem like they're synonymous. But fact is really just it's the exercise of belief, getting us to believe certain things, whereas truth is what is actually going on. So really what they're saying here is we're closing down this museum to refocus our belief, what we believe in. They're not talking at all about what actually happened. We're just redirecting what we want our people to believe in.
And what's very newspeak here is what they're trying to do is say this is a museum because that conjures certain, you know, historical artifacts and we go to view things. But they flat out say this needs to be a propaganda piece. We want people to come in here and understand that we believe in Jesus, right? That's not what a museum is for. And that's what, like, Bible Land in
the Creationist Museum.
Yeah. Isn't Bible Land in Orlando? I think I've driven by it. Yeah. You know, you don't go there if you want to learn, like, Palestinian history. It's there about feeling good about something, right? It's there about verifying one's beliefs.
You go there when Hogwarts is sold out.
Yeah.
But that's just like the visitor center. Like, I can't wait to see what they think the difference is. So.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. The church has some fascinating artifacts in its possession, and it's a shame that they can't, maybe someday, but the fact that we're going to really have like dioramas and wax statues of the 12 apostles is really heartbreaking, because the actual history of the church is very fascinating and very interesting, and it's a story that needs to be told rather than trying to convince the world yet once again that they're just another Christian sect. All right. Well, one last story. It hit the national news, so I thought I should cover it. The students protested BYU this last couple days ago over beards. Here's one thing you can't do, and this once again is Orwellian. I told you all the stories are very Orwellian. You cannot expose the church's absurdities. So the problem is because then you back them into a corner. Once you protest that you can't have a beer at BYU, the church has no answer for that, right? There's no explanation for it whatsoever. And the history of it goes into the counterculture in the 1960s. That's when that came about. But no one's going to acknowledge that. That's gone down the memory hole. So, the church can't respond to this. So all they can do is shut it down. And, you're not, it's a catch 22, I guess, to mix our, our metaphors, our literary metaphors, the church gets backed in a corner. They one thing they can't do in an authoritarian regime is ever seem like they're bowing to democratic pressure. They can't do it. So every time you have a protest, you set the clock back 10 years. But which is like one of those puzzles your dad used to give you when you were 10, you know, if you had done this, then I would have done that. You know, it's kind of bullshitty, but yeah. Well, good for you, BYU students. Good luck with that.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is a listener-supported production. Visit our website, mormonexpression.com, to tip John's swear jar, or become a subscriber and help keep the show running. Thank you very much. We can't do it without you.
Well, let's get to the crux. I have been alluding for the past 270 episodes to two things generally. One is the rise of the Nazi party in Germany. You know, I had somebody push back. I wasn't even related to me, but somebody said, basically, I want to give my brief defense for bringing up the Nazis all the time. Because it is kind of cliched, but, the thing about the what happened in Germany and all of Europe and all the world in the 40s is fascinating because they are us. Our technology has advanced, but, in terms of intellectually where we were at, in industrialization, sort of this postmodern world, they're not very different than us. And here you see something that rose up from a very sophisticated, very progressive society. Germany, especially of the late 19th century, was a very progressive intellectual place. And the fact that this movement was able to come, and we even talk about the Nazis like they're the fountainhead of everything. They're not. They're part of other movements that were going on. And I think, and because of the horror of the Holocaust, there's those who say this is such a sacred thing that we really shouldn't talk about it. But it's unfortunate that all these other things that were going on in there get covered up. And I go back to that metaphor because it's fascinating, because they're us. We're them. And but for who knows what, we can go that way to fascism and to totalitarian police states in but a few years. So they're so close to us, where if I give examples of Alexander the Great, it's so far removed, and, you know, it's how do we relate to them? So that's one of the reasons. Of course, the second metaphor I use all the time is 1984. Hardly an episode goes by that I don't make some sort of reference. And it's amazing how much of our thought has been influenced by Orwell. As I was doing the research, I did not know this, but Orwell coined the term Cold War. Much of the way we perceived all this stuff has been influenced by Orwell. When I first read 1984 when I was in junior high school, which would have been the mid-80s. So with my first reading of the book, we were in the height of the Cold War. And Orwell himself, especially with Animal Farm, tonight we're going to be really focusing on Animal Farm and 1984. They weren't very hidden metaphors. Like, he was talking specifically, directly about the communist regime in Russia in particular. And especially with Animal Farm. Animal Farm was written in 42, 43. It was written in the war when Stalin was gaining power. 1984 was written in 1948 and published in 1949. So it was post-war, but a lot of the thought was about this rising communistic police state. One thing I think is interesting that I learned about Orwell that I didn't know before is he was a socialist. And after I read that, and I could see it in his writing. And we might come back to that. But it's funny because me and everybody else in the world is always appropriating all this stuff from Orwell. But I think we tend to ignore the context of it. And speaking of taken out of context, actually comparing George Orwell to the church is actually taken out of context, but we're going to do it anyway. All right. So that's sort of I gave a background on Orwell. Did you guys know he was a socialist? He's a democratic socialist.
Yeah, I mean, I learned just through when you invited me on this podcast, it was months ago. Mm-hmm. I've read 1984 numerous times. It's in my top 10. I mean, I just love it. But I'd never read Animal Farm, so when you invited me on, I went and read it that very next day, and then I read it again the next week with my wife. And the character Old Major, he's the big fat pot-bellied pig that dies at the beginning of the story. He is an allusion to Karl Marx. Right. So he dies at the beginning of the story, and he leaves all of the other beasts with this one last song. It's their anthem to live by, Beasts of England. And yeah, that's the allusion to Karl Marx.
Yes, and you know, you can start naming off all the other characters. You know, Snowball might very well be Trotsky, and you have Napoleon, who is Stalin. And by the time he wrote it, and Orwell's talking, you know, Animal Farm really maps out. So let's start with Animal Farm and sort of give a synopsis. Has everybody read this book? If you haven't, it's available. It's the copyright is expired in Canada. So if you have an internet device that can somehow get across the border to Canada, you can get a copy of it for free. You know, I don't know what Orwell's estate is, but he's been dead for a long time.
The audiobook's like 3 hours. I mean, it's an easy listen. It's two podcasts.
There's a cartoon that's kind of fun to watch. So Animal Farm is about the overthrow of Jones's farm. And this is where, if you know that Orwell's a socialist, a democratic socialist, you can start seeing this comparison. He's not a fan of Jones either. As a matter of fact, my favorite character in the book is Benjamin, who is the donkey. And he has a quote, "Life would go on as it has always gone on. That is badly." So he keeps repeating as they're going through this revolution, because no one knows how long Benjamin's been alive. He's just, "I've seen this all before. I will see it all again." And in the end, what Orwell's basically doing is calling the communists a bunch of pigs, right? In the end, of course, the pigs start walking on 2 feet. We'll get to that. And what he's saying is you've got Jones the capitalist, and you've got the communists coming in who are just the same thing. Just the one is a totalitarian police state, and they reach the same end.
Well, what they don't realize on the farm at the time is that he's so ambivalent because he, like you said, they have no frame of reference as to how long he has lived. So they don't know to trust him. This is all going to come full circle.
Right, right.
You think you're on a good path, but just wait to see how this ends.
So in the book, the animals Major, this old pig, sort of calls them all to the barn and gives them this rousing speech about how they're all just used for the benefit of the few. Jones and his farm is using them, taking their eggs, taking their young, selling everything. And when they're old, they'll just be sold down the road for glue or whatever, that they'll just work hard their whole life. They'll never have any reward. And that's it. So Major dies and inspires this revolution. They kick Jones off the farm, and then they set up Animal Farm, a collective of the people. And they come by and by, and they with their doctrine, and the pigs are the thinkers. Now, what's interesting and not lost on Orwell is a pig's contribution to a farm is its own death, right? A pig has no role on the farm other than to be eaten. And Orwell's making a statement here about those who, by necessity, have to live off the labors of others. So even though the pigs came up with this, that the pigs have the most interest in getting out of Jones' farm because they're going to die.
That's the genius of it, though, because they don't really have a role. So now they do, being in charge.
But once they're in charge, and they have to set up their structures to, you know, the pigs are the smart ones who have to make all the rules, because they're in the same boat that Jones was. They're living off the labor of others. So Animal Farm sets up 7 commandments. Whatever goes upon 2 legs is an enemy. We have to vilify whatever came before us. Whatever goes on 4 legs or has wings is a friend. No animal shall wear clothes. No animal shall sleep in a bed. No animal shall drink alcohol. No animal shall kill any other animal, and all animals are equal. So as we go through the story, we see these rules start to get changed. And I'm going to give you my first complaint about Orwell and my first disagreement with him. And actually, as I read the book this time, and this is probably about the sixth time I've read the book, I'm not nearly as sold as I was back in the Cold War days and when I was younger. I think Orwell makes some huge mistakes. He was still talking in the future, so I don't fault him for that. But there's people who are afraid of, like, 1984 is going to come to pass. I don't think so. But we'll get there. So the pigs start modifying the rules. So the first, they paint these rules up on the side of the barn, right? And then the animals wake up the next morning, and they'll see the rules modified. And then the question is, did it always say that? Because not all the animals can read, right? They're not all as smart as the pigs. And the first change, I think, is no animals shall sleep in a bed without sheets. So they add without sheets to the bottom. So they start adding this nuance. And then no animals shall drink alcohol to excess, because after a while the pigs start getting into the hooch, right? And then no animal shall kill any other animal without cause. Right. And then finally, all the axioms are replaced with one. One you've heard so many times, you probably don't even realize. Two maxims, aren't they? All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And then, of course, four legs good, two legs better, which is a complete reversal, right, of the original, of what defines one to be an animal and what defines the economic system. And that's where it ends, right? The pigs turn into people, and they start having commerce and trade and drinking with the humans, and the humans accept them and say, "Oh, you're one of us now." And so it goes.
Yeah. Weirdly familiar, as the Mormons went from being quite odd to very Protestant over time.
Yeah, we'll get more into the Mormon stuff here in a minute, but yeah, I'm sure my dear beloved audience is following where I'm going with this stuff. 1984 was written in 1948 and released and gave a dystopian view of the future after what he calls in the book English socialism, or ingsoc. Now in 1984, we're in a state, it's about 30 years following the post-war period, and Orwell envisions, like, nuclear wars in the 50s and eventual settlement of the world into three states, although it's not clear in the book if these actually exist. Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia. So the world has been settled into these three mega empires, all communist socialist states. And then they just fight endlessly over the disputed territories, which are like Africa and like Micronesia, and I think they mentioned Antarctica, and they're just in a perpetual, never-ending war, one with the other. And usually two of them are allied against one. The structure, the breakdown of this society is that there's really three classes of people. There are the proletariat, which in the book it says comprise about 85% of the population. They're poor, they're uneducated, and they're fed a steady dose of alcohol, pornography, and the lottery and gambling by the government. And that keeps them satiated. That's kind of prophetic by Orwell. I'll give him one there. Then you have the outer party, which is about, what would be the math, about 12-13%. And because the inner party is about 2%, they analyze. The outer party is our protagonist Winston and his girlfriend Julia. They are part of the outer party. And the outer party is watched and observed constantly. And the focus of the book is on the life of being an outer party member. The world is inside ingsoc, inside Airstrip 1 is the name of Britain in the book, revolves around these two shadowy figures. The first figure is Big Brother. Big Brother is the ostensible leader of Oceania. And he's on posters everywhere. They hear his voice all the time. No one ever sees him. But he's omnipresent everywhere. Our posters that say Big Brother is watching, and they're just plastered absolutely everywhere. The second figure that figures into this is a guy named Emmanuel Goldstein, who is the nemesis, who is the turncoat saboteur, who is constantly causing problems. And every day, in fact, they have what they call the two-minute hate, where they all get in front of the screen and he comes up and he talks. And in the one epic scene, he actually, in the film, turns into a bleeding sheep. Is it a sheep or a goat?
I can't remember.
In the book, the communists did this, actually. The Russians did it. And they did it, turn the person into a goat. And I think in the book, he turns into a sheep. So Orwell does pull from historic events on this. But then everybody just hates and they start cursing at the screen. And Goldstein, whatever his name is the embodiment of the hate, of the enemy, of the other. And of course, the war is always flipping between East Asia and Eurasia. We're always at war with one of those two people. But you better know which one it is. And we'll get there in a second. So Winston's job, he works for the Ministry of Truth. And his job is actually editing historical documents. So what the state does is whenever somebody is executed by the state, which is all the time, they become what's called in Newspeak as an unperson. And the state will delete them from the record permanently. Did you guys see the picture, the Russian pictures of this, where they had pictures of Stalin with his board and then a released one that the Russians actually did this, in the Stalinist era, where they would actually go and take somebody who became an unperson in Soviet Russia and actually delete them from the record. So one of Winston's main jobs was to take the newspaper, and then they would go and they would rewrite the article to remove the person completely. So when you became an unperson, you were deleted from the entire history, and that's Winston's job. He sits at a desk where there are two tubes and a hole. The one tube, the newspapers come down because they're still editing up newspapers that he's rewriting. The other comes the instruction on what he's to change, who he's supposed to unperson. And then they have, of course, the memory hole, which you've heard. The memory hole is a hole that's everywhere. They say it's walking down the hall. It's there. So any scrap of paper that you have that you want to get rid of, that you want to disappear, you put down the memory hole. And it ostensibly goes down to these incinerators and gets burned up and never to be found.
John, for the audience, if you're interested in another movie that's very similar to this and someone that alludes to this, it's Terry Gilliam's Brazil with the evacuated tube system and all the messages that are being transported through it.
Brazil is a fantastic movie, but you have to be very careful which edit you see.
Is there a risque version?
There's a Love Conquers All, which was done by the studio, which go see Brazil. It's a great movie. Enjoy it. And then sometime on a Friday night when you want to get drunk, go see Brazil Love Conquers All, and you'll see how in the real world a studio can completely fuck up a movie, and they just destroyed it. If you haven't seen it, you should just go see it. Film schools actually show this as how much you can do, how much you can change a film, just through the editing. Okay, so we're once again going through this story. Winston is not happy in his job, and he's not satisfied. Well, he buys a journal and starts journaling, and then he meets Julia, who he when he first sees her, he wants to kill her. He wants to rape her and kill her, which is important. But then she passes a note onto him and says, I love you. And they start meeting secretly and to have a love affair.
John, can we stop for one second?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's important to note the main source of Winston's angst. And it's what I brought up earlier. It's that distinction between truth and fact. And Winston's job at the ministry was to fabricate fact. It was to engage in newspeak and to give the society something new to believe in, to redirect their attention. And the source of his angst is that he was constantly aware of what was true, though, and he couldn't get that out of his heart and his mind.
Well, that's what they told him his job was, right? there is a psychological trip through this book, which is you don't know what's real throughout the whole thing, sure, even up till the ending. So, and we find out, for example, and I apologize for giving spoilers. This book has been out for 6 years. nothing that they send down the memory hole actually gets destroyed, or at least they can reproduce it all, right? They pull things up that he's burned down the memory hole. And it turns out that everything Winston has done, they know about from top to bottom. So the question, if you start thinking about it, is was his job really to edit documents? Or was this just their way of
just
monitoring
an exercise,
him?
Sure.
Because what we find out in the end, and it really confused me a lot of times. The book's in three parts. The first part is about describing Ingsoc and this world that he lives in. The second part is about his illicit love affair with Julia. And the third part is really about his torture and brainwashing to the end.
Reindoctrination, sure.
And the question always comes in, why do they do the why do they do the indoctrination? Why do they spend so much time? As a matter of fact, there's a visceral sign of this in the book where they starve him. And I read also this was an actual technique that the Soviet Stasi did, that they would starve people and they wouldn't clean, they wouldn't wash, they would be thin, emaciated. It says that he'd lost most of his teeth, and then they'd show them a mirror. They wouldn't let them see themselves, and they'd say, this is who you are. You think you're so great. Then they feed him again, and surgically repair all of his teeth, and they put him back into society. So the question you're left with in the book is why? Why would they bother doing this? Why don't they just shoot him? Boom. Why don't they just get rid of him? Why do they bother indoctrinating him? If they are just going to end him in the long run. And they tell him that. They say, and he even acknowledges that the people who disappear will oftentimes reappear for a while, and then they'll disappear for good. And, you know, they'll come, they'll do their confession or whatever, and they'll be released into society, and then they'll disappear. And the answer, really, I think, is that let's talk about thought crime. They have so much control over the outer party at this point in the book that they know exactly what everybody's doing. As a matter of fact, it's very clear that O'Brien, who is Winston's main torturer, that O'Brien can read Winston's thoughts. So O'Brien can tell him exactly what he's thinking. The implication that Orwell has is the sophistication, the technological advancement over the Stasi and the police observing has become so advanced. And they're watching these people all the time. And almost they imply that it might be 2, 3, 4 people watching every one outer party member. That they get so, you know, watch them through their sleep. They record everything they say. They know everywhere they go, everything they do, that they can read their thoughts, right? The party is interested in thought crime. They're not really interested in what you do. As a matter of fact, it says in the book many times that most things aren't illegal. That there's no written law. But what they're looking for is the people who are not, who haven't internalized the value of the party. And what the book is ultimately about is this collectivism, that what they want are people who know how to do doublethink, people who will not commit thought crime. That's what they're after. And what Orwell is trying to tell us is the collective will one day trump individualism to such an extent that the individual doesn't matter, that all they're trying to do is hone their own methods so that they can eventually eliminate thought crime or anybody who basically thinks on their own.
Yeah. You're doing a great job describing it. I'm just waiting for all of the connections between this and...
So that's the setup. So we're here to talk about Mormonism, right? first of all, let me talk about a couple of issues I have with the book. The one I just mentioned, first of all, Orwell depends on the thought police being able to basically read people's minds. That ain't going to happen anytime soon. You don't need to worry about that. If there's anything we've learned over the past 150 years is police states are dangerous in the short run, but in the long run, they're incompetent. And it's really, really, really hard to maintain a police state. And historically, the only way to do it is to basically have a slave class. And because slavery has fallen out of fashion, the societies that did it for a long, long time, like the Romans, did it on the backs of slavery. And when you have pseudo-slavery, like, say, the Russian system, it's very difficult to maintain over a long period of time. And so that's the one thing I have, is Orwell imagine some of these technologies that used to monitoring people that are just really over the top.
And in fairness, I mean, you're saying this, and I never gathered that from any of my readings of the book. I guess now that you're saying it, I remember O'Brien actually speaking Winston's thoughts to him, but I always interpreted it more as he's just always being observed, and Orwell really tries to emphasize how Winston he was a writer by trade, but then he started going off on his own and just writing his own thoughts.
Potentially.
So I don't know if it's so much that he was he actually reading his thoughts, or was it he just knows his mind because he's been watching him for so long and reading his words?
I assumed that it was more of just kind of an assumption that you feel like you know someone, and so after a while of literally living with them or watching them constantly, you feel like you've come to know them, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of the way I took
it. Yeah, I agree. I'm not positing that Orwell's saying they have ESP. It's right. That thing, but the idea is that through such observation and such control, they could get to the point where they could predict exactly what he was going to do, exactly what he was going to think. And I think human beings are more complicated than that.
Yeah, they could predict, I think. But like you said, it's not really a long-lasting kind of a thing because you actually can't read people's minds and or tell exactly what's going on. Because if you're just thinking and it's boiling under the surface for years and years and years and you're not acting, you don't know what's about to erupt.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Don't you think that I'm kind of hearing you saying that this will be like an instantaneous change on a societal level. It seems like it's much more subtle than that, though. I mean, it takes years and years, and I think Orwell's alluding to this, though, that this isn't something that happened overnight.
No, and he talks a lot about newspeak is about where they're going. This desire to engineer the way people think and process the world. We're going to come back to that a lot when we talk about Mormonism. I think that issue I'm talking about is a minor issue. I think the biggest issue with the book is, frankly, I think Orwell is sort of a racist bigot. and the problem he has is the proletariat. And for example, he posits this outer party. And I think this is the reason I want to go into this is this is going to come more in when we talk about Mormonism. This outer party is under constant observation. And one of the things that Winston does and other people in his department is whenever they want to change a book, they change it there and then they go recall all the copies and then publish new ones, which the church has done. I've got two copies of a book at home that are both first editions that I can show you where the church has done a change. It's in Lee, who is the president of the university. They recalled the books very quickly, then reissued them under the same first edition. I have them both, so I can prove to you personally that the church has done this. The problem is that in the book, all this information is going out to the proletariat, which is 85% of the population of Ingsoc. But Orwell never describes how the hell they get all these books back from the proletariat to go reissue them. As a matter of fact, the proletariat doesn't like the monitors that are around, that the outer party has to be subjected to. The outer party, there's these TVs that are on constantly that are being used to watch. And Orwell basically states in the book a couple times that the proletariat is stupid and they're going to stay stupid. The problem is regression towards the mean. Whenever you have a if you were to divide the population, you get all the people who love pornography and the lottery and alcohol, and you were to put them in one section of the city, they still breed, and their children are not inherently as stupid as they are. And the party children are not inherently as smart as the party members are. And this is a huge hole in Orwell's theology, because what Orwell basically says, the proletariat is never going to revolt, but the actual course of history shows that the intercourse between the classes is happening all the time. Now, part of the book, and I think it's because Orwell kind of ran out of ideas, but part of the like three or four chapters of the book is actually Winston reading Goldstein's book. So they're just straight out of that. And they talk about something that's very interesting, and of course it resonates with Marx, where he said there's three classes of people. there's the people who have all the power, and their interest is taking the power, the keeping the power, retaining the people, the power. Then there's the group that's right underneath them, and their interest is always is in swapping places with the powerful. So they want what the powerful have, and the powerful don't want to give it up. Then there's everybody else, the proletariat. The proletariat knows that they don't have access to either of those positions, so the proletariat's interest is socialization. The proletariat's interest is getting rid of the system altogether. And you see this oftentimes. It's something I read about in college, that oftentimes in businesses, the people who are most interested in preserving the social structure, like the fact that the executives sit in bigger chairs, are not the executives. It's the guys who want to be the fucking executives. They're the ones who really want to make sure there's red chairs.
Because you got to aspire to that.
Because you got to aspire to that.
You know, that's Alexis de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America, in a nutshell. I mean, that's his thesis, is that the thing that makes America America is the belief that you can become something greater than you are at some point. And that the second that that illusion goes away, we become just like any other society that is constantly switching caste systems and revolutions and overthrowing, and then a new powerful regime coming in. And so far, America's lasted 225 years plus, and only time will tell how well we do. But I mean, it is that one principle that has really kept us going, is this belief through all of the classes that we can become greater, that we can transcend.
It is. But I do think that there's some truth in what Orwell's saying, that the masses tend not to care.
Well, part of it is because the books are out there, like you've always said about Rough Stone Rolling, just because every Mormon has that on their shelf doesn't mean they actually read it.
But there will be some that read it.
Absolutely.
That's the flaw I see in 1984, that the word would get out, that the inner party can control the outer party, but they can't control the proletariat. They acknowledge it in the book, and they say, we don't have to, because they're dumb and stupid.
But don't we, I mean, in fairness, I've had this conversation with my father a number of times, and you know, he's open-minded enough that he started listening to Mormon Stories, and he's dabbled a little bit in your podcast, not nearly as much because you say fuck too much, John. Mm-hmm. But the conversation that we've had is when you're in this, and when you're going through this, and you're listening to the podcast, and you're reading the books, you feel like you're looking around and thinking, how is everyone not aware of what is going on? And the truth of the matter is everyone isn't aware, and the majority of people really don't care. So I get your criticism, but I think it takes a long time. I mean, if the proletariat continues to behave the way that the proletariat does historically, it's not so often that the proletariat rises up and that they, you know, overthrow a regime based on an ideology. I mean, they may do it just in a fit of rage, but it's rare that it's ideologically based.
Well, what's the line from Dazed and Confused? That I like high school girls because no matter how old I get, they always stay the same age. The proletariat will always be there. It's true, but the proletariat, the uneducated masses, the people who are just happy going to Walmart and eating McDonald's and all that kind of stuff, there will still be new intelligentsia born out of the proletariat. That's what I'm saying. And I think that in Orwell's dark vision, I'm just saying that is the Achilles heel of his system.
Sure.
Is that the inner party could not control the proletariat. Sure. And there would still be people rising up out of that. Okay. So let's, with no further ado, let's talk about Mormonism and Orwell. And I think it's very interesting because the way that the proles are kept under control is by keeping them undereducated and then giving them diversions. Specifically, like I said, alcohol, pornography, and the lottery are the ones that Orwell talks about quite a bit. The society itself is kept in control, we learn, through a couple of mechanisms. One is perpetual war. It is very important that there is always this war going on. And the war works on two fronts. We have the war with Goldstein, and we have the war with
on a national level.
With Eurasia at the beginning of the book. But actually this is the kind of mind fuck as you go through the book. You don't really know if there's any war at all, actually. And you don't really even know if there's three, if there are three civilizations. Because you get all that information from Goldstein's book. But it's pretty clear that he's a fiction, right? And O'Brien gives who is thought police, gives Winston the book to read. But you kind of read it along and accept it all. It gives this big, long explanation. But the question is, why would you accept any of it? Because Big Brother and Goldstein are equally important in controlling the masses. Now let's look at religion. Religion functions equally important on having a savior and a devil. It has to have both characters. It has to have an other. And every major religion that I know of that has not only a devil that's out there in the metaphysical world, but it has a devilish people who are out there, the others. The non-believers, the heretics, the apostates, the abominations of doctrines, you know. You look in early Mormonism how demonically it characterized Catholic doctrine, dogma, and Protestant dogma, and that this perpetual war, to these type of societies that Orwell is describing is imperative. And when you see fundamentalist religion, it's always there. They are always in a state of siege. They are always about to be overrun. The world is always about to end. And, you know, in the book, there's constantly rockets being dropped. But as commentators point out, and that kind of hints at in the book, there's not really any enemy that could drop the rockets. It's most likely the country dropping them on themselves. And Ingsoc keeps the place in rubble and a state of filth on purpose because it helps control the individuals who are in the society.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a section in the book, and it's often glossed over because it feels like it's commentary, but it's Orwell discussing why war is actually essential for the perpetuation of this type of system. I mean, you cannot have a time where you're not constantly in opposition to something,
because
even if that opposition isn't real.
Yeah. You need the opposition. You need them to have fear at all times. It keeps them busy. And yeah, absolutely.
And focused on things like chocolate rations.
Right. Yeah.
Right? One of my favorite quotes from the book. This is Winston talking about, he's talking about boot production. And you forgive me because I'm going to read a big paragraph, but it's very key. But actually, he thought, as he readjusted the Ministry of Plenty's figures. So he's going through and he's changing these figures to match. Like they announced the prediction of the figures, and then they announced the later figures. So Winston's going through and adjusting them in the newspaper. So they're. It was merely the substitution of one piece of nonsense for another. Most of the material that you were dealing with had no connection with anything in the real world, not even the kind of connection that is contained in a direct lie. Statistics were just as much a fantasy in their original version as in their rectified version. A great deal of the time, you were expected to make them up out of your head. For example, the Ministry of Plenty's forecast had estimated the output of boots for the quarter at 145 million pairs. The actual output was given as 62 million. Winston, however, in rewriting the forecast, marked the figure down to 57 million. He's made it up. So as to allow for the usual claim that the quota had been overfilled. In any case, 62 million was no nearer the truth than the 57 million or the 145 million. Very likely no boots had been produced at all. Likelier still, nobody knew how many had been produced, much less cared. All one knew was that every quarter astronomical numbers of boots were produced on paper, while perhaps half the population of Oceania went barefoot. And so it was with every class of recorded fact, great or small. Everything faded away in a shadow world in which, finally, even the date of the year had become uncertain. So the point is, he's doing this job, and this is why I say he's purportedly doing this job, but his job is complete nonsense. Like, he's substituting one figures for the other, and none of that has no bearing on anything. Let's look at the church. The church is constantly talking about numbers, right? And ex-Mormons are constantly talking about numbers. Are any of these numbers anything to do with any reality?
Verifiable.
Are any of them verifiable? Even some of the things that we know. Like, the church says that if they lose somebody, they keep them on the record till they're 110. This is what the church says. Who the fuck knows if that's true or not? Like, why do we take the church's word for that, right? Like, how do you even know? Seriously, I know some ex-Mormons who spent a great deal of time every spring conference, and they deconstruct all these numbers, and they add up units, and do, da, 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 da. There may be no boots produced at all. You don't know what you're dealing with here. Zero. As a matter of fact, the church has so many people working for it. And we know from people who come out of the church that it has safeguards, that the systems are separate. And I've heard that there's only one person, one accountant, who actually has view into all the different accounts and these different things that I've heard from insiders. Why do we pay attention to this number at all? Why are ex-Mormons always saying, oh, the number's too high? The number's just a fiction. It's a game. Here is, I'm going to skip ahead. I'm going to come back to my stuff. But here's the darkest revelation I had in reading this book. I'm fucking Goldstein.
I wrote that down.
I literally wrote that down in my notes.
Right here. Is JL or JD?
Because.
That is so funny.
The church, the people in the church say all the time, why do people leave the church? They can't leave it alone. There's good reason for that, which we've talked about quite extensively. But what if we did? What if we all left it alone? What if we all just walked away? Because I'm playing into their narrative, right? Here with my IPA and my cuss words and my pornographic thoughts and everything that they say is going on, I'm playing right into their system, right? That this is what they say will happen. This is one of the reasons it's so important to have nonsense rules, like don't drink coffee or don't drink hot drink, or just go through. We recorded a whole episode on. Go through and try to figure out what the hell the DNC 89 says. It's just a mess, right? But it's double thinking. We haven't got to double think yet. And it's imperative. And this point is so important. This paragraph is one I've contemplated over the years more than anything else. Because so many times we play into the system, right? If you're not a Democrat, you're a Republican. Who the fuck made those rules, right? What? How do you get those two out of all the possible positions you can have in American dialogue? One's 62 million boots and the other's 57 million boots. And are there any boots at all? And we fall into, I don't mean to sound like conspiracy theorists, but we fall into these paradigms so easily. So often I and other people play out the church's script, right?
I don't think it's conspiracy theory so much, John, as, and people are oftentimes accused of being conspiracy theorists. It's just that when your religious beliefs break down and you get to a point where you're agnostic, if you will. You just say, I don't know about everything. It's so pretentious when your political or your worldview beliefs, they don't follow the same path, when you're still so certain about what's going on politically in the world or what's going on with the Republican or Democratic Party, or when we have a national vote that 67 million people really did vote. Like, how could you possibly ever verify something like that? You're just taking it at face value, so much as that there's 15 million people in the church, 4 million of which aren't currently going. I mean, there's really no way to verify any of this stuff.
Absolutely.
It's not conspiratorial. It's just
Well, that's where O'Brien goes and gives this long, on your point, gives this long lecture to Winston about that they argue that history doesn't exist. It only exists in your mind. And then Winston fires back and says, you're talking solipsism. And O'Brien says, it's not solipsism if everybody believes the same lie. And what ultimately Big Brother and Ingsoc is about is getting everybody to accept and buy the same lie, because then it doesn't matter. Well, I think luckily with the age of the internet, it's a lot harder to break this down. And what you see is some of these patterns that the church followed that are right out of the playbook. And let's go through more of them. But the internet and the free access to information, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to hide and bury information for the church. Okay, there's a great phrase that I think really applies to Mormonism. It's going to make me sound like a dick, but it's called protective stupidity. And it's a role, it plays a role in doublethink. And there's a word in Newspeak called black-white. And I'm going to read you the description of black-white from the book. The key word here is black-white. Like so many other Newspeak words, the word has two mutually contradictory meanings. Applied to an opponent, it means the habit of impudently claiming the black is white, in contradiction of the plain fact. Applied to a party member, it means a loyal willingness to say the black is white when party discipline demands this. But it means also the ability to believe that black is white, and more, to know that black is white, and to forget that one has ever believed the contrary. The demand is a continuous alteration of the past made possible by the system of thought, which really embraces all the rest, and which is known in Newspeak as doublethink. Doublethink is basically the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. In psychology today, we have a word for when somebody becomes aware that they're doing this. We call it cognitive dissonance, right?
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Two opposing ideas that are made equal or congruent.
Right. But doublethink precedes, the ideas you're talking there, because it speaks to the ability to hold those two thoughts simultaneously without cognitive dissonance. And so what is going on with Winston, with the outer party, in my view of reading the book, is that the inner party is looking for people who can embrace doublethink.
You know, when you're not live, you can just stop at any time and edit that out.
Sorry, the AC wasn't on. You guys are just thinking you're getting all heated up by my fantastic words. Yo, this guy's got me I'm going to start like throwing my panties at him like Elvis. No, it's just the air conditioner. Where were we?
Newspeak, doublethink.
Doublethink. So doublethink is imperative in a system like the church. And what they're doing with Winston, in my view, in the book, and in his job, and they imply, I think Winston one time says that he knows he's not the only one writing this article. And he knows, and I would assume because he's seen his own articles come back, and sometimes they get picked up and sometimes they don't. So the implication is the party gives out this rewrite that he gives to Winston to everybody, to 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 or 100 different people. And so what the inner party is doing with the outer party is they're looking for people who are skilled in doublethink. They are looking for people who do not commit thought crime. They're looking for people who will just accept what the party says to them, even if it's contradictory. And Winston gets destroyed because he's not one of them. And that's what O'Brien's trying to tell him, is you just do not have the ability to adopt the hive mind. You didn't do anything wrong. You are wrong. And when you see systems like the church, the way the church systematically grooms people for the top, and this is not the church. I tell you, IBM's doing the same thing, you know, and Wall Street's doing the same thing. And, you know, they hire these type of people who they know will be successful. And I read an article in the New York Times today. It talked about why everybody hates their job. And passage mentioned they did a lot of research, and they found if they empower employees to say, this is what we want you to do. We want you to do X, Y, and Z. Just get it done. This is your job. Do X, Y, and Z. Get it done. That not only will employees be more productive, but everybody's happier. But the article talked about management refuses to do it. Even though they know it works, and they say, why does management refuse to do it? Because we can't measure people. Like, why do you care? X, Y, and Z are done. Well, it goes to the discipline of the system. The system is become about the systems. And this is the message of 1984. Because the question you say is, who's running this? Why do they want people to starve? Why do they want all this to happen? Because the system itself has taken over and become a bigger consciousness than the consciousness of the individuals. Where in the past, the capitalists were about their own greed. But Ingsoc is about the power, the raw power of the system. And I think he says that Winston breathes the words, God is power, meaning the only thing that matters is power. And the power systems will develop on their own. And that's what it's all about. And so when we see the church doing the same sort of things. This, if you're a good missionary, you can become, you know, you become a bishop, and a bishop becomes a high councilman, a high councilman becomes a stake president becomes a mission president, becomes a 70, who gets put into the 12, who gets systematically groomed over 80 years to take the top mantle. And there's a lot of ex-Mormons who say, surely these guys have to know that the church is not true. Surely these guys at the top can look and see all the doublethink that's going on. They can look and see the flat contradictions. They can look and see that the church is saying white and black at the same time. And I say, read this fucking book, because they've been systematically groomed their entire lives to be super good, double plus good at Doublethink.
Well, this is, God, as you're describing this, John, I just got this wave of fear because there's two, there's common threads between both of these books. But the difference between Animal Farm and 1984 is Animal Farm, it's clear that it's about class distinction, but you know who's in control. The pigs are in control. They have subversively gained control, and they've done it through Doublethink, and they've done it through Newspeak, and utilizing the same tools. What you're describing here in 1984 is a system where it's not clear if anyone is even in control. There's just some big other that's in control. And the question is the church led by, excuse the analogy, but is it led by the pigs that have consciously gotten to the top, or is it now a system? And I think you're probably correct that it's systematized at this point.
Absolutely, which is why it's in the straits it's in. The church has its own corrective mechanism. It ostensibly believes that the leadership can receive revelation and can self-adjust. But I would say if you look at the publications of the church, especially over the last, maybe since David O. McKay, that doesn't speak like somebody who has authority. The system has taken over, and they've really lost control of it, in part because I think that they're bred for a kind of systematic cruelty, kind of like we see in 1984, meaning the church has no problem shaming people and humiliating people and excommunicating people and ostracizing and breaking up families and not letting people go to weddings and all this sort of terrible action if you saw it outside the context of the church. But it's run by good people. This is Doublethink, right? Because they can put the church above the actual families, all the while saying the church is about supporting families. And once you remove yourself from the system, you start looking at it in the abstract. You're like, wow, it's nuts, it's crazy, but it is Doublethink.
So, John, I've heard you bring this up before, and I just want to go back to something that you posed a second ago, where you said, if you are Goldstein, and let's say that all of us are Goldstein, you step away. You're maybe not an anti-Mormon, if you will, but you step away and you're just no longer attending and you're no longer active. And so you just posited that it's possible that if we just left it alone entirely and just completely just ignored what was going on, that may be an arrow into the system, if you will, because it needs that opposition. But, I mean, do you think that would actually work, or would it just shift and just a new Goldstein would arise, the Southern Baptists or the Catholics or Islam, or I mean, is that a potential solution? Because you talk about the people in the burning building, and that's why you stay. That's why you continue to care. I mean, and all of us have those, though. You see that there's this system. You see that people are hurting, and you can get to a point where you're comfortable with it, but then you still have loved ones that are in your life that you worry about. I mean, is that an actual solution?
I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. That's why I've been flailing around like a maniac for 5.5 years. You're exactly right. I don't know. I think we're up against, in terms of religion and particularly fundamentalism, and Mormonism is this sort of microcosm that we can study in a safe way because Mormons really are safe. They're not about to chop your head off or fly an airplane into your building or anything. But fundamentalism in the history of the world keeps resurging and is violent and is bloody. And the question for me, I've gone from thinking about the small in terms of Mormonism to this bigger problem. I believe that religion is a byproduct of a remnant of our group psychology. It's in our DNA, the way we socialized when we were in smaller groups. And then we moved to bigger and bigger cities and bigger city states and more military power. And religion plays into our psychology. Can we break that cycle? I wish I could say that I'm growing in optimism on that, but I'm not. What I see is that these systems keep rising and will keep rising. The lucky thing is I don't think Orwell talks about them having eternal life. And I don't think they will. I think they'll be replaced. I think the proletariat will eventually overthrow the systems. And I think there's a general course in history of getting better. But more fundamental to the question of who I am and what we're doing here and what do we do about the problem of the church is something that keeps me up at night.
Sure.
I don't know. I know that sometimes I play into this hand, sometimes I play into that hand. I flail back and forth, and it's because the answer's not apparent.
It takes away I hope that it can get better, and I hope that things will figure out a way to deal with it and with our families and our friends and the people that we care about that are still in it. But the fact that all of the individuality is completely being taken away bit by bit from when we were younger, you're younger than us, Adam, but when John and I were younger, like, you didn't have to wear a white shirt every Sunday, and no one cared how many earrings I had and stuff like that. But all of those little things are being taken away to where there is no individuality. Mm-hmm. And it's really a little bit scary, and it may not be physically bloody and physically violent, but it certainly can be emotionally.
Well, but
and psychologically.
Yeah, I mean, John brought up, fundamentalism, and we have fundamentalism in our blood. The negative side effects of fundamentalism, they don't happen overnight. I mean, Dan didn't just go and stab his little niece and his sister-in-law because he decided to do it the day before. It was subtle. It was years and years and years in the making. And it wasn't even his lifetime that amounted to that. It was other people's lifetime and fundamentalism passed down over and over and over again that finally manifested itself in that way in his life.
Right. I mean, it empowered those guys, but those guys were still lunatics.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So I don't know. It's a tough problem. But let's look at some of the few gems in the book that we have to address and that I think are brilliant. First of all, one of the sayings of Winston has three revelations he's writing in his book when he's going through reeducation. 2 + 2 = 5, which is a theme that comes up over and over again, which was the saying, by the way, of the Soviet Union during the second 5-year plan. And Orwell's playing with it, but it was 2 + 2 = 5. What they were trying to do, of course, in the Soviet era, they had the 5-year plans, where they're trying to achieve economic growth. And let's not buy into all the propaganda you heard in school. The Soviets were able to push Russia really far, really fast. And in 1957, when they launched Sputnik, they took the world by storm. But in the second 5-year plan, they were trying to get it done in 4 years. They said 2 years + 2 years. Equals the same, the 5-year goal. So they had a saying, 2 + 2 = 5. Orwell's playing on that. One of Winston's revelations, 2 + 2 = 5, freedom is slavery and God is power. And we'll come to those. One thing that Orwell writes in the book is freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4, which I think is one of the most profound things in the book, especially when you look at something like the church. Freedom is the freedom to be able to say what is true. To be able to say what is right. And when you have an oppressive totalitarian police state regime, which is what the church has, mind you, they don't have guns, but they will go after what's the most important thing to the church? Families are forever, right? And they'll take that away from you. And they will say to you they can destroy your marriage, they can, if you get excommunicated, you lose your children, you lose your spouse, you lose everything that's dear to you. So without violence, they use psychological violence the best way they can. So freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4, which when you have a healthy organization, when the church is really healthy, then people will be able to stand up in sacrament meeting and say the way things really are. They can really get up and say, Joseph Smith married 30-plus women, and he married some women under duress, and he married very young women. And you do not have the freedom to say that in the church right now. You cannot say 2 + 2 = 4. The other concept that I find that Big Brother is omnipotent and the party is infallible, but they say something very important. He asks the question, how can the immortal collective brain be mistaken? This is something you hear in the church all the time. The church is true, but the people aren't. The immortal collective brain of the church has to be true. It cannot be the church that has problems. It can only be the people. And that is fundamentally the philosophy of Ingsoc, right? It's not the Ingsoc is perfect. It's just people like Winston who keep fucking it up for the rest of us. And the church is perfect, but people are imperfect, and they keep doing things that screw us up. So let's leave off with talking about the three noble truths of Ingsoc. you often memorize, right?
Hanging on the wall.
In vinyl.
War is peace.
Freedom is slavery.
Freedom is slavery. And what's the third one? God damn it. What is it, Michael?
Something about ignorance.
Where is it in our notes here?
Oh, Randy listens to the recording.
I used to get a call like 5 a.m., 6 a.m. Monday morning. Somebody says, hey, you know, this was in the podcast. And then we go and fix it. Yeah, so let's talk about freedom is slavery first. Because I think
that's the strongest connection to the church.
Yeah, well,
personally.
Yes. So let's table. Let's talk war is peace first. Because what this is saying is that when we talk about the perpetual war that the church itself engages in, by doing so, somebody's in a safe place. And I actually remember hearing this when I grew up in church, that get to a safe place. You're safe as long as you're in the church. The world is so full of war that the only safety is here. And it's the same thing that Ingsoc has, that the only way people achieve peace is by having this constant war that's out there at the borders, because then we're okay here. But the more important one is freedom is slavery. And the way the church would say this is you have free agency. But as soon as you exercise your free agency, you will lose your free agency. And you will be in prison. And you will make poor choices. And you can't see the poor choices because the natural man is an enemy to God. And man is not free to act one way or the other unless he's enticed by the Spirit. So the only way for you to achieve freedom is by being a slave, is by doing exactly what you're told in exactly the way it's done. You're a homosexual, it doesn't matter. You need to find yourself somebody of the opposite sex and have kids. You like mountain climbing on Sunday, it doesn't matter. You need to sit in the pew for 3 hours, you know, and you can just go on and on and on and on that point.
Yeah, I was listening to one of the Voices podcasts the other day, John, and what's the gal's name that's been running most recently?
Katrine.
Katrine. And she was talking about her own story when she was being interviewed with her brother Jason, and she told her story of getting pregnant with her first child. And just her thought process as a teenager, I mean, all of us can understand it growing up Mormon, but it was that if she and her husband went and bought condoms before having sex, it was a conscious decision to have the sex. But if the sex just happened, then it's easier to ask for forgiveness for sex that just happened, that was just in the moment. So she has this consequence that will be forever lasting, and she's very grateful for this consequence. But that's one of the worst thing that the church does to us all when we're growing up. And it may not be an implicit thing that's done to us, but we're not taught just the power of consequence. You know, that true freedom is slavery, but really true freedom is being able to actually be free and to just understand consequence. If I do X, it's going to lead to Y. You know, existentialism in a sense, responsibility. Can I accept can I be responsible enough to accept the consequence to this decision? If I can, go ahead and do it. If you can't, avoid it.
Well, and I like what you're saying about conscious, the consciously accepting that, because one of the phrases in the book is stupidity is as necessary as intelligence. That in order for the system to be perpetuated, this doublethink requires a willful suspension of intelligence. And you see that very intelligent people who are in the church presented with prima facie evidence that the church is not only not true, it's a logical impossibility for it to be so. They will put that aside and adopt the double speak, the double think. And that is so imperative for the church to keep going. And when people willfully accept that, trying to convince them on a logical basis, the church isn't true does not work at all. And if you try to do it to people, you're just going to anger them. There's the one last quote I'll end with from the book. Until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. And this is the paradox of leaving the church. Until you become conscious of the doublethink, the willful ignorance that you have, the suspended intelligence in favor of belief, you'll never rebel. You'll never leave the system because you're not conscious of that. But until you rebel against the structure of the church, you cannot become conscious. There are few people who, for whatever reason, they wake up. And I've been around thousands and thousands of these people. And the one thing I can tell you is it's completely inconsistent and not predictable as to why people decide to leave the church. Sometimes it's like they like to jerk off. Sometimes it's because they want to drink a beer. Sometimes it's because they heard something that doesn't make any sense. It's individual. But there's a spark. And the scary thing about the book and the scary thing about the church and what makes me Goldstein is this paradox. You can't convince them otherwise. And four stars.
Yeah, you can't convince them. You have to let them find it on their own like we did.
Yeah. I'd say, at least for my closing, John, I'll bear my testimony for a second. But no, honestly, George Orwell, I felt like when I went on my mission, looking back on it in hindsight, that I was functionally illiterate. I mean, I could read words, but I could never conceive of what I was reading. I just kind of coasted my way through high school, and college was just totally out of the question before I left. But I look back on it, and the first book that I read when I came home after having all information controlled for 2 years, you can read these seven books and these seven books only, was 1984. And I would just recommend it to anyone if you haven't read it yet. It's just it's a worthy read, and Animal Farm is fantastic. And I feel like somebody like Christopher Hitchens. I mean, people may not agree with what he said or think that he was too brash, but it's strange as you age that prophets and apostles and these church leaders were once your heroes, and now George Orwell and a Christopher Hitchens, these guys are people that have influenced my life, and I feel really grateful for them and for their bravery. So thanks for having me on, John.
One last comment. I do agree that a completely 100% totalitarian system can't really exist, but the thing that's closest to it in the church, in my opinion, is the honor code office at BYU. Like, those people are big brother to a team. So, yeah.
Well, it's amazing how oftentimes you see these patterns emerge. Yeah. And, you know, how many words from the – I was going to make the list, but I didn't have entered the vocabulary. You know, doublethink has room 101 has the memory hole is something people who don't even know the book will say the memory hole. It's gone down the memory hole. And these patterns you see and I think that's – whether or not the book is predictive is not as interesting as it shows us these patterns that emerge in controlling institutions and really takes apart why controlling institutions are not concerned about truth. They're concerned about manipulating truth. And once you start asking yourself that question on the church, and remember from our news stories, we saw like three or four stories where that happened. You know, the church's response to the beard controversy, where they just sort of shuck and jive. They don't need to give any sort of answer. The church's subtle manipulation of language around women's conference. We didn't even go through some of them. There's some other phrases they dropped. The church and its museum and coordinating history. You know, you start seeing these things come up where ideally you just say, yeah, this is just our history. It's because they're in the books. Go read it. You know, you don't try to control it. That's when you're going on Ingsoc territory. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another great discussion. Thanks to our studio audience. A reminder, if you've made it this far, we're still looking for the host. I will be retiring at the end of 2014, and we have an open call for individuals. You can send an email to mail@whitefieldseducational.org, or you can send one to John at mormonexpression.com. I'll tell you what we'll ask you for. We're going to ask you for a 10-minute demo tape of anything of your own choosing. So if you want to skip the first step, you can just send that to us.
John, is this you retiring from the Bulls or from the Washington Wizards? Michael Jordan retirement. which one is it?
It's a good question. I enjoy podcasting. I'm tired of talking and thinking about Mormonism. Oftentimes, topics like this take a lot of research, and I don't really have the energy for that, but I enjoy podcasting. We still have our sister podcast, Reasonability, which will be recorded here in 10 minutes. You can check me out there. Go to reasonabilitypodcast.com. Or you can go over to johnlarson.org. I have some new podcast projects that I am working that will be launched soon. So you can still hear my bedroom voice if you want. All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is recorded live before a studio audience in Salt Lake City on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Come down and join the audience, take part in the podcast, and meet John and the panelists. The Mormon Expression Podcast is produced by the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find out about our counseling services and other special events.